You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you very much to all of you for being here with us this morning, for taking your valuable time to join us in this very topical and important discussion. Thank you very much to the members of the panel, Tito, Charlie, Sting, Alessandro, Guillermo, for sharing with us your wisdom. I hope you're going to shed light on this very muddled topic of using prudential instruments or regulation to do macro policy. As you probably know, the Brookings Serious Economic and Social Policy Initiative, ESPLA for Friends, is a partnership between the Global Development Economy and Development Program here at Brookings and the Center for the Study of Economic and Social Affairs, CERES, in Montevideo, Uruguay. So ESPLA is a relatively small initiative within Brookings. So what we seek is to forge strategic alliances with prestigious institutions, thought leaders in the region, in Washington, D.C., or wherever they may be, that are doing serious public policy research in Latin America. So this report and this event are an example of this kind of strategic partnership. So I would like to express my deep gratitude to the World Bank in the person of my very good friend, a superb economist, the chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean of the World Bank, Augusto de la Torre. So, Augusto, the podium is yours.
Well, I want to welcome you, and I'm happily surprised to see such a good crowd for such an abstruse topic, which is remarkable. We at the World Bank are particularly pleased to partner with Brookings and with Ernesto in particular, to do this event. I'm supposed to introduce a little bit the topic of the study, so I'll try to do that in three levels. I'd first like to take Ernesto's term that this is indeed a muddled area, this one of macroprudential. It's muddled because it brings together profiles that are normally not often talked to each other. This is the community of supervisors and regulators with a community of macroeconomists and financial economists. And these are communities that, from my own experience, are hard to bring together. They think differently. They even walk differently. They have different reference points. They have different concerns. In fact, the difference was perhaps highlighted in those years where the winning theory seemed to have been that it was a good idea to separate regulation supervision from central banking. Many important economists proposed that, and in fact, the Bank of England did that precisely. And when I was a central banker, we talked a lot about the risk that having regulators and supervisors inside the central bank was a risk because it could undermine the autonomy and the purity of the central bank. We do live in different times now. And we're bringing them together. Still don't talk too much among these communities, but they are at least together. They are forced to think and to overcome the failures and the gaps that we actually encountered in the architecture we had developed prior to the global financial crisis. I think one of the big quests we're after is to escape from what I believe became a fallacy of composition, particularly among regulators, which was the idea that if every financial institution is sound and safe individually, then the system will by definition be sound and safe. And it turned out to be a fallacy of composition because, of course, macroeconomists know that macro aggregates, systemic behavior, sometimes do things that cannot be found in individual parts or the individual players, that there's something special and important about systemic and macro phenomenology. And I think this is the time in which we're living. We're trying to escape this fallacy of composition, but we really don't know how to do this well. And I think there are three levels in which we're struggling. And today we're going to talk about one of them, but let me mention what the three levels are. First, we're trying to scope out what do we mean by macroprudential policy. It's supposed to do something. It has to do something with systemic risk, it seems. It has to do something with aggregate shocks, aggregate fluctuations. But, of course, not every fluctuation in credit, for instance, has to be attacked by macroprudential regulation. It would be silly to regulate anything that moves, right? So we have a big challenge as to ascertaining correctly which type of credit fluctuations and financial risk building need to be attacked by regulation. So scoping is a big one. The second one is about what are the instruments and do they work? And so there's a whole toolkit there, and it's an area where we're doing much, but we do not much what we're doing. And today we will focus on one particular instrument which straddles this area of concern of regulators and macroeconomists. And I'm very, very happy that for a period of time my office was blessed with the presence of Charlie Begg, a fantastic macroeconomist who became interested in macroprudential issues. But, of course, you will see it's from a macroeconomics bias point of view, a regulator would say. But it's an important view. And Charlie chose one instrument, which is legal reserve requirement, to study how effective they may be for some purposes. So we have the issue of effectiveness and instruments. And then I think the third level, which is even more complicated, seems to me, is the area of trade-offs. So you do something with a macroprudential purpose, and you may damage something else. You may distort some incentives. You may introduce a particular cost that you are unaware of. And you may create inefficiencies that are not due to the market failure you try to correct, but they may be due to the wrong policies that you're introducing. And some members of the team, particularly Tito Cordella and Samuel Piengnagura, under this project did a paper that explores some of these tensions between macroprudential objectives and microeconomic distortions. So as you see, this is a very rich field, and I think we'll have fun today listening to, I guess, at least one of the papers or perhaps some of the ideas that came out of this project, which was conducted in the last year in my office with the leadership of Charlie Begg and the help of Eduardo Bulletin and Tito Cordella and Samuel Piengnagura, and even I and Alanise did something to add to this project. So I'm happy that we can share this with you today. Thank you very much for coming.
Okay, so how do I... Yes. I'm going to put my glasses to see the... Okay, so it is a pleasure to be here, and I like to do thank especially how Gusto de la Torre and also Tito Cordella for their for their hospitality for the whole year that I spent at the World Bank working on this project. So we don't have much time, so let me get right into the key questions that the report tries to answer. So
The first and perhaps most important question is how has macroprudential policy been conducted over the business cycle? And by that we mean, has it been countercyclical? Has it been procyclical? As Augusto already mentioned, for the empirical part of the report, we are going to focus on a reserve requirement policy for two main reasons. The first is that it is by far the most heavily used macroprudential tool, and the second that it is also by far or perhaps the only macroprudential tool for which you can get a very long time series. If you would try to get a time series, say, for capital requirements, it is actually very tough to get like a long time series, because we are really coming from the macro time series point of view. We had to have this long time series, so we are going to see that the reserve requirement policy is going to differ quite a bit between industrials and the developing countries, and then we are also going to look at the question of whether a reserve requirement policy acts as a complement or a substitute for interest rate policy, and then we'll bring in to the picture a foreign exchange market intervention in order to look at a trio of policy instruments that are reserve requirement policy, interest rate policy, and foreign market intervention, and that is a very important policy menu that we argue that emerging countries have resorted to both in bad times and also in good times. We show in the report that the policy mix of this trio that is chosen by the developing countries differs quite substantially from the policy menu chosen by the developing countries, and will tell a story as to why this may be the case. And then the policy report closes with two broader chapters. So in the next to last chapter, we look at what we call the unintended micro effect of macroprudential tools. And there the idea is that you can have a bunch of prudential tools that are equivalent from a macro point of view, but that can have a very different implications at the micro level, and in particular as to how they affect the risk-taking by individual banks. And then we closed the policy report with a broad discussion of how to go about thinking about the optimal design of an overall macroprudential framework. And here, in some sense, this whole debate of rules versus discretion comes up again, which is very common in macroeconomics, and we contrast what we call an all-terrain macroprudential framework that will not vary over the business cycle. We compare that to a state contingent macroprudential framework that would vary depending on whether the economy is going through bad times or good times. Okay, so very quickly, as I said, the empirical focus is on resource requirements. The database covers 52 countries, 37 emerging and 15 industrial. The sample varies from country to country, but for some country we have been able to go as far as to 1970, and very important, we have been able to collect data at a quarterly frequency that is very important to be able to look at the cyclical properties. So the main operational decision in some sense that we had to make, because we want to ask the question which countries have used reserve requirement policy for macro stabilization purposes and which countries have not, right? So obviously for that, if you are doing empirical work, you need to come up with some operational definition that is going to allow to classify countries between active countries and passive countries, right? So what we did, which to us makes sense, is to look at the frequency of change in resource requirements. Because think about a time series of these are legal reserve requirement rates. So this is a time series that is going to look at this continuous. So it's not like your standard macroeconomic series that is changing all the time. So it actually looks like a price of an individual good in a supermarket that is not going to change for a long period of time. So we compute the frequency of change. So this chart here has the quarterly frequency of change. So for instance, if you see a 0.5, it means that this is a country that on average is changing reserve requirements every 2 quarters. The yellow bars are developing countries, the black bars are industrial countries, and you can immediately see in the chart that the developing countries are changing reserve requirements much more frequently than industrial countries. And actually, there are a whole bunch of black bars that you don't see because they belong to industrial countries which have a zero frequency, partly because many of them don't even have legal reserve requirements. So based on this, we adopt what we think is a very natural definition of active versus passive country, and we compare the average duration between changes in a reserve requirement with the average duration of the business cycle for each particular country. So the idea is very simple. If you're a country like Chile, whose business cycle has an average duration of 2-3 years, and you change reserve requirements every 10 years, it is safe to conclude that Chile is not using reserve requirements as a macro stabilization tool, right? If you have a country with the same average duration of business cycle, 2-3 years, and they change the reserve requirements every 2 quarters, while it may be true that they are doing it for some other reason, it is a very good bet that the main purpose of these very frequent changes is to try to smooth out the business cycle. So based on comparing these two things, we classify countries in passive and in active countries, and you can see that if we take the whole sample, about two-thirds of the developing countries historically have pursued an active reserve requirement policy, whereas only one-third of one-third of industrial countries have, and none since 2004. And I'm going to show you two pictures here, and I'll be done. So we have put our countries in two bags, the countries that are active and the countries that are passive, and we have argued that two-thirds of the developing countries have been active. So for those countries that have been active, we compute, because we have quarterly frequency, we compute the correlation between the cyclical component of reserve requirements and GDP, and as you can see, a vast majority of the developing countries have pursued a counter-cyclical reserve requirement policy. And this is very important because this is not always the case. I mean, Guillermo is going to show you that actually when it comes to monetary policy for some reason that Guillermo will explain, it has been common for developing countries to pursue a pro-cyclical monetary policy. So keep in mind that by and large countries, developing countries, have used counter-cyclical reserve requirement policy. And my last slide is, so if you break the sample before and after 2005, you know, which is consistent with this idea that we read in the financial press, that many emerging countries, think Brazil, think Turkey, and other countries, have made heavy use of reserve requirement policy for macro stabilization purposes, to the point that you don't have a single industrial country that has been active since 2005, and all the developing countries that have been active, all but two, have been highly counter-cyclical in their use of reserve employment policy. So I'll stop here and give the floor to Giza.
So as Carlos was just showing us, there is a striking difference between the behavior of developing countries and industrial countries, right? Industrial countries typically having a more passive use of reserve requirement for macroeconomic stabilization purposes, and developing countries being much more active in that field, and particularly being quite contracyclically. So when thinking about this, why is it these people are behaving so differently, it's very important to take a look at the other usual suspect when thinking about macroeconomic stabilization from a central bank regulation, financial regulation point of view, which is the interest rate policy. So what we have here is the correlation similarly to the one Carlos was showing us, but instead of using the reserve requirement, we're going to use the interest rate of the central bank. And what we get here is, by and large, a completely different picture. Black bars being mostly positive, so industrial countries behaving mostly contracyclically, increasing interest rates in good time and reducing interest rates in bad time. The evidence on the developing world is much more complex. On average, it's acyclical, but what you see is some of the bigger players in the world behaving procyclical. In other words, what you see is many developing countries increasing interest rate when output is going down, which might seem like, why are they doing this? Well, they are doing this precisely because they typically try to defend their currency. So interest rate policy is not that much tied with macroeconomic stabilization purposes, but much more to defense currency. And when you think in that way, then the contracyclicality of reserve requirements come as a nice natural way of trying to ameliorate output fluctuation. In other words, if you have interest rate policy tied down to exchange rate fluctuations and capital flows fluctuations, then you might want to use some other tool, if available, in this case, the reserve requirement, for macroeconomic stabilization purposes. And that's a little bit of the story we are building upon, that these two instruments work differently in two different set of countries, in particular in industrial countries that do not have larger issues of capital flows, exchange rates, appreciation, sudden depreciations, and things like that, where they have institutional and policy credibility. Maybe just one tool is enough to deal with what they need to deal with, which is mostly output fluctuations. So in order to truly articulate what is going on between reserve requirement policy and central bank interest rate policy, what we put together was this policy mix matrix. Basically, on the columns, you have whether interest rate policy is pro, A, or contracyclical, and on the rows, you have whether reserve requirement policy has been pro, A, or contracyclical. And this is a nice way of figuring out where are countries located most of the time. So the first thing to notice is that, as we just said, most industrial countries that are identified with bold fonts are in this cell. And in particular, they are on the contracyclical use of interest rate policy. On the other hand, most of the developing world are somehow over here. I want to die here on the stage, at least not today. They are more pro-cyclical or acyclical. And this matches what we found, what we just described. What is super, super interesting is that when you take a look at reserve requirements, as we just described, in most of the cases, at least for this very long time horizon, they are not actively used in industrial countries, but they are very, very heavily used by developing countries, particularly Brazil, and we will see later in a more recent time, Turkey. So the question is, why is that going on? Well, building upon this issue of having two potential tools to deal with one or two potential problems, depending on which country you come from, we developed this term. So we are trying to articulate whether central bank interest rates are substitutes or complements to reserve requirement policy. In other words, if you are on this side, on the pro-cyclical, acyclical side on central bank interest rate policy, that doesn't allow you to deal with output fluctuations. So in that sense, if you use reserve requirements for contracyclical purposes, we call it substitute. Substitute in the sense that you are using reserve requirements to do something that interest rate policy doesn't allow you to do, precisely because interest rate policy is tied to something else, in this case, exchange rate and output fluctuations. And in some other cases, you have them being used as complements in the sense that you are used a little bit of both. Both tools, the interest rates and the reserve requirements in those cases are used to ameliorate output fluctuations. So once we have that in mind, and we build upon, again, this idea of countries using, many countries in the developing world using interest rate policy and reserve requirements as a substitute for each other, I would like to point out and stress some particular difference when taking a look at the pre and post 2005. So one of the things you hear is, first of all, when taking a look at developing countries, first period compared with the second period, you see quite a shift from countries going from the left towards the right. So this is what we call in one of our papers at the Chicago Fed, the graduation of monetary procyclicality. So many countries in the developing world, precisely because they are gaining institutional credibility and policy credibility, they are being able to move from a procyclical stance on the monetary policy to a more countercyclical part. We also call, and let me introduce some sort of interesting term, we also call this cell the promised land. The promised land, at least from a de facto revealed preference point of view, is where most of the advanced economies are, where most of the industrial countries are. So basically, one way of understanding this cell is thinking that these countries have one tool, monetary policy. They use that for output fluctuations. They don't need to use something else for sudden and very intense changes in capital flows and exchange rate defense, currency defense. And precisely because of that is that we call this the promised land. How is that developing countries move from the left towards the right in pursuit of that promised land? It varies. In some cases, like Chile, it went still straight, direct from a pro-cyclical behavior in monetary policy straight to the counter-cyclical way, and this is what Carlos was describing in terms of Chile being one of those countries that rarely changed reserve requirements. They mostly invested in credibility, in institutional quality in the central bank. They gained that so they can use interest rate policy for output fluctuations. In other cases, and we see a lot of this in many developing countries, and not surprisingly, Brazil is there, Turkey is there, what is happening is there is a more longer road towards its promised land. And what you see is mostly either coming this way or this way. In other words, before getting to this promised land that requires a lot, truly a lot, of institutional and policy credibility, what they typically do is exploit both tools they have. In that case, what they are doing is using interest rate policy with less frequency as a procyclical, in a procyclical way for exchange rate defense, but at the same time, they are using reserve requirements in a contracyclical manner. In other words, they are using this new tool they have, and this is what you see a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago, both in Turkey and in Brazil. They increase interest rate to some extent to defend the currency, but they also reduce reserve requirements for macro stabilization purposes. So how is that this substitutability, the typical substitutability or the typical path of many of these developing countries work? Well, we all know that during bad times we have capital outflows in most of these countries, and what we have in those cases is what we call the fear of free falling. So typically when you have a slowdown in economic activity or in many cases drop in economic activity, capital outflows, pressures towards depreciation, what you do is you increase interest rates for currency defense purposes, you use policy interest rate because of this fear of free falling. You somehow lose, you just lost this policy rate for fear of free falling purposes, and you use reserve requirements to stimulate the economy as a substitute. And during periods of capital inflow, periods of good times that are associated with capital inflows and appreciation of the economy, you do exactly the opposite. You reduce the interest rate to ameliorate the currency appreciation, and you use reserve requirements to cool off the economy. You increase reserve requirements to cool off the economy. So far what we have been talking is about these two instruments. But of course we know that in reality there are much more instruments. One of them that is particularly used also in the developing world is foreign exchange rate interventions, so the use of foreign reserves for stabilization purposes. So what we also explore in the report is what is the relationship of this trio, of this interest rate policy, reserve requirements, and now put into the picture reserve requirements. So these are some impulse response functions that are the result of a positive GDP shock. Let me translate this into a negative GDP shock because it's typically the kind of thing that we have in mind in these instances. So, for example, if you have a reduction of output, what you have is interest rates going up precisely because they are trying to defend the exchange rate. So we are going to flip all these graphs. And if you have a GDP reduction, what you have is a reserve requirement reduction. This is the kind of substitutability we were just referring to. What is happening on the international reserve fronts? You would reduce the number of reserve requirements. In other words, you will use reserve requirements also to ameliorate the pressure on the exchange rate to depreciate. So in this sense, one may think that interest rate policy and international reserves go hand in hand and they are used as a complement from each other, while reserve requirement is a substitute, both for interest rate policy and by transitivity for international reserves. So this gives us a picture of the trio. Maybe there is a quattro or something like that. So what are the policy implications we found in the report? As Carlos was saying, the reserve requirements have been actively used in a contracyclical manner, particularly in the developing world, not that much in advanced economies. Maybe they are used for something else, but not for stabilization purposes at that kind of frequency. Reserve requirement proves to be an effective instrument to affect output, often substituting for interest rate policy. The rationale is that interest rate policy is tied to exchange rate and capital fluctuations, and in that context, reserve requirements appear as a second natural tool to be used for output fluctuation purposes. And as Carlos was saying, in terms of the micro, and Augusto was also mentioning the issue of micro tensions, we have to be aware, and this is part of all the report, we don't have time to explore that much into detail at the presentation, high reserve requirements may increase individual banks' risk-taking behavior. So this is something to take into account because we are typically more concerned, at least through the eyes of most of the report, in macroeconomic implications, but be aware there are very important micro implications. And we also touch upon in the report, and this is part of a bigger agenda, in terms of whether the macroprudential framework should be thought as an all-terrain kind of framework, or it should be tailored to be state contingent. And of course, once you get into that road, it's much more tricky because you have to get what is a state contingent that we are living and have the expectations about future state contingents of the economy. So with that, I think this is most of the most important stuff of the report. I think we truly did a tremendous work in terms of all the scope that research typically moves us around in terms of the process of gathering the data, identifying the important instruments, bringing these, interacting with the most important policy tool that has been typically looked, which is the interest rate policy. And we also have more work on the theoretical side, trying to reconcile some tensions between the macro and the micro side. Thank you very much.
Okay. Carlos Guglielmo, thank you so much for the presentation. I'm in a sort of an odd position of being a co-author and a moderator, so there is some corporate governance that maybe should be checked carefully. Anyway, here, let me just briefly introduce our panelists and discussant. They're probably you all know them pretty well. Stine Klassen, who is Assistant Director at the Research Department at the International Monetary Fund, and Alessandro Rebucci, who I think now, I don't know if he's left or is on leave from the IDB and moved to the Carey Business School at Johns Hopkins. And I think the sort of the common feature of our panelists is that, well, they're very serious scholars, and actually what they show is that it's possible to continue doing very interesting and state-of-the-art research because or despite working in international financial institutions. So, Stine, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Tito. Thanks for inviting me to be here. I enjoyed reading this report. I've been exposed to this at several occasions in Latin America. I think Mexico, we went to Uruguay. So I find it very topical. It's extremely well done. It's a pleasure to read. It's very good in documenting these patterns that people have talked about before, but we haven't seen it done in terms of documentation that rigorous over such a long period, such a large number of countries. Much of the reasons for using these reserve requirements is, of course, related to external vulnerability. So the report zeroes in on the archetypical Latin American situation, but it doesn't mean that it's excluding other countries. So the comparison is very valuable because then we can say what works and what doesn't work. It clearly shows that monetary policy in these countries, and including reserve requirements as part of the monetary policy paradigm, is very different from what has been done in other countries. We knew that, of course, before. Other people have remarked on this over the years. Actually, in terms of research, it's become a kind of a new area of research. People are saying, okay, we may have to think about these countries as kind of using two targets and two instruments. They target both the inflation as well as the exchange rate. They both use monetary policy, but also use foreign exchange intervention. This paper falls in that literature, quote unquote, in the sense that it's really addressing something that in practice seems to work quite well. These reserve requirements have delivered us quite a lot of stability in the region, but more globally. But I think, and this is going to be kind of the theme of my comments, is we're still behind in terms of analytical modeling. We don't, in some sense, have a good model to explain what is very well documented in this paper. So in that sense, we're a little bit struggling because models matter. Now, for some people, models don't matter, and I'm an empirical person myself. But in this case, I think a model matters very much because you can only then, of course, do kind of a welfare analysis and start comparing this tool vis-a-vis other tools. There are lots of other things. I mentioned foreign exchange intervention. The report touches on that, but it's not able to draw a final conclusion on what's best because it doesn't have the model, so to speak. And also, when we start calibrating these things, we really would like to know a little bit more what is kind of driving behind these things. So when you're faced with a capital outflow, as some countries may these days, how do you balance exactly? What do you lower, how much, without getting into the fear of floating? If you do it too much, maybe you have some problems. So I think the literature is really in search of a model. Now, being a little bit more of the micro person, I tend to think, well, this must be about financial frictions. There's some imperfections here. So maybe this is similar to sterilized intervention that sometimes works because there are frictions there. Maybe it's similar to QE, which, I mean, Guillermo mentioned this, advanced countries have this Nirvana, et cetera. Well, I think the Nirvana is actually being questioned these days, so maybe we shouldn't hold them up so much in that upper quadrant there. Maybe they're going to come back down to the middle as well. But in any case, the model is clearly important. Is the problem born in the private intermediation? Do we see the frictions there, and then the monetary policy, including reserve requirement, is responding to that? And the paper, or the report, gets into that more towards the end than towards the beginning. And I think that's, in some sense, a little bit maybe a frustration for me to say, okay, maybe you should have done the model first, both on the micro side, which it does now, but also on the macro side. It's a challenge, but I think this is where we are. That doesn't mean that the report isn't very good in documenting it, but we do want to do that as well. Now, let me give you three more specific comments in the time I have. One is the term macroprudential. And this is a little bit maybe sticky IMF or whatever debate. They use reserve requirements as being part of the macroprudential. I think that's okay, but they also link it to macroeconomic management. And I tend to think of macroprudential much more geared in the first instance at financial stability. It's macroprudential like we think of microprudential at financial stability at the individual level. And secondly, could from time to time also have economic management consequences because one is feedback to financial stability, or you don't have the other tools available to do macroeconomic management, so you start using the macroprudential tools for some macroeconomic management. It's probably more in the latter category, but I think using terminology right is important because there's a lot of confusion out there, and if we open the Pandora box even more, people may be doing whatever they want to do and calling it macroprudential. That's probably not where we want to go. Credit intervention, distortions, you name it. So that's point one. Second, as I said, I'm struggling with the model, and it even starts a little bit from, okay, is it closed or open economy? So let's take a closed economy, which is simpler, and then we can maybe move to the open economy component. In a closed economy, in the very basic textbook, Blanchard, whatever, and I know Blanchard was emailing with Carlos, so he is saying, well, isn't it in my textbook or in a textbook? Doesn't have to be his textbook. Isn't it all equivalent? Reserve requirements and monetary policy, you raise reserve requirements, that's more or less equivalent to interest rate. And I think that's Olivier's kind of and Carlos's area. I think of it more from the micro side again. I think of reserve requirements as a tax. It's a tax you impose on financial intermediation, and what's the tax going to do? Now, that's the report. Says correctly, I think, depends on the capital of the banking system, or the individual bank, actually, what it says. If you have a tax on a highly capitalized banking system, it may lead to more risk-taking. If you have a lowly capitalized system, it may lead to less risk-taking. So it's really the interaction on the micro side with the capitalization of the banking system that you have to look at. Now, then if you overlay that with the business cycle, it's not obvious where you end up, and actually in the report in the end says that very clearly. It says when the cyclical use of taxes to dampen the credit cycle may exacerbate the tension between micro and macroprudential policies when the cycle is driven by interest rates. That's maybe a lot to read, but it basically says that we have to be careful here, but you use these things. You may actually make the boom worse or the bust may actually become more severe. So reserve requirements are used quite a bit, as we notice, but they have some costs. And this is where the model, again, becomes important. And I'd like the report, or at least the literature going forward, to really address that. Third point is a link with capital flows. It's explicit, implicit in the report a lot, and for the countries in question, Latin America, it is key, of course. But presumably, again, it depends. Banks better be important, because otherwise reserve requirements wouldn't matter in the first place. Presumably banks are involved in FX lending or they have a large stake there, because otherwise if I have capital flowing into the country to the stock market, I may still get the macroeconomic consequences and reserve requirements are not going to do very much in the first place. Which makes me think that this is probably going to be a tool that you may want to use, but maybe you also need to use capital flow management tools, because in some cases you're not going to get to where the real problem arises from the capital flow side, which is through the capital markets. And it also means that reserve requirements, if you're going to be using them, may have to be increasing quite a bit, because if you really want to stop a boom in a time when house prices or equity prices or asset prices more generally are increasing, it's hard to do that with a marginal increase. You really have to do it quite dramatically. So I think this is where I want to end up by saying, if you can integrate everything in a nice context in a model, we all be better off. We don't have that yet, but I think this is where the literature would want to go, and then the report can be even more useful than it already is. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Alessandro.
Good morning. Thank you, Tito, and the organizer for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. My first professional assignment was assisting Carlos and Ernesto as a research assistant on procyclical fiscal policy. So, and we have had discussion about the challenges of inflation targeting and what may not work and why countries do certain things for a long time. So it's a great pleasure. I want to second Stein in just stating it's a great report. And the reason why it's a great report, because not only It describes the policy before attempting to analyze it, but it also provides the good data that are necessary for both steps, and then both steps, the description of what's happening in the policy, in this policy area, and a first pass at analyzing it is offering the report. So I've seen the report before and the background research, and I think is so persuasive that in my own research I took that direction and I've done something similar on capital control, starting to describe and see what's happened before analyzing. The report, or today we got off talking about a new policy tool. I would like to stress the fact that this is an old policy tool which has a new use. This is important to understand some of the pictures that we've seen in the report, and also understanding that indeed things are moving forward. This is why industrial countries are in a different space than an emerging market, but also to appreciate what's happening in emerging market. If we think about the experience in Europe during the post-high-inflation period, there was something often used also at the IMF, a transition toward the use of indirect instrument of monetary policy. That meant moving away from quantitative target, including the use of reserve requirement for conducting monetary policy, and trying to use prices, try to use interest rate to conduct monetary policy. Emerging markets, once they have, they largely abandon exchange rate as anchors for monetary policy, they embrace this transition toward using interest rate to conduct monetary policy, but they soon face that there were a lot of difficulties in doing that. So it's not surprising that when a flexible inflation targeting framework with the interest rate as the main instrument and the exchange rate that works as a shock absorber reverts to reserve requirement as the first place to go when things don't work as expected. So my second point is an attempt of distilling why inflation targeting may not always work the way it is supposed to do, but the way it seems to be working in advanced economies. I think I agree again with Stein. There are frictions. There are frictions that in modeling term makes inflation targeting not the optimal monetary policy. I would like to simplify and think about financial friction manifesting themselves through capital flows and real frictions. Real frictions perhaps in the past, in the early times of the transition from fixed exchange rate regime to floating regime were problem linked to pass-through, very high pass-through of exchange rate movement to inflation. Nowadays, more recently, we've been very concerned with Dutch disease, the dislocation consequences of appreciation on the upside of the boom. So in the presence of these frictions, if we want to label original sin, fear of floating because of pass-through, inflation targeting does not deliver the promised desirable economic outcomes of the textbook. So in this context, it's not surprising that emerging markets, which had not completed the transition toward pure inflation target or more advanced form of inflation targeting, have used, as documented, this tool in they have used. What I think is interesting from the facts documented by Guillermo and Carlos is that if we bundle the time period, for example, if you look at the overall sample from 1970 to 2011, we have a picture. When we look at a more recent period, we start to see a little bit of a story which makes sense relative at least to the benchmark of best practices in terms of policy advice. What I found particularly interesting that if we were to disaggregate further, we would start to see some countries using both the interest rate in a countercyclical manner and the reserve requirement. For example, think about Brazil. Brazil in 1998 responded to the pressure on the fixed exchange rate regime, just trying to use one instrument, the interest rate, and they failed miserably. They had to exit the peg, and the cost of that defense was extremely, extremely high in terms of output loss. In 2002, a very similar situation emerged before the crisis, before the election, and what Brazil does. In the big scheme of things, they didn't touch the interest rate. They left the interest rate completely alone, and they dealt by using reserve requirement, another measure in the interbank market. With the support of the fund, they managed to solve with exchange rate intervention, reserve, and foreign liquidity, they managed to withstand the crisis with much lesser output cost. Let's now look at 2008. Again, if you think about Brazil, what Brazil did in 2008 was initially, after Lehman, essentially responding the same way it responded in 2002, using the second instrument. But then starting early in 2009, when the market were calmer, they also complemented the second instrument with aggressive lowering of interest rate. So that's an instance in which initially the two instruments have been used as complement, say in the last quarter of 2008. Starting from the first quarter of 2009, they were, initially a substitute, but starting with the fourth quarter of 2009, they were used as complement. They were helping each other. So I agree with Stein that we need a model for calibrating the use of tool, better understanding what the policymakers are doing. We do have a better modeling framework for capital control because there are non-nominal rigidities in that environment. It's much simpler. And one important lesson that emerged from that modeling environment is that there is an interaction between two instruments similar to the reserve requirement and the interest rate. And in particular, in the models, we can see that the effectiveness of one tool affected the desirability of the use of the other tool. So there is an active interaction. So if we transpose that paradigm to interest rates and reserve requirement, we understand what's happening. When the interest rate is ineffective, either in the crash or at the top of the boom where we are carry trade, when we are fearing to further increase interest rate, is attracting even more capital flow, we use the other instrument. When in a state of the cycle in which the first instrument is relatively effective, so dealing with nominal business cycle, then we see less of a use of the second instrument. And here I would like to stress the fact that there is an important distinction between the all terrain and the stay contingent type of use of this kind of instrument. Again, Stein hit the right spot when he said, careful, because the second instrument is very useful in certain state of the cycle, but it has implication for financial development. Now, if we go back where we started, the difference between advanced economy and emerging market is that the degree of financial development is different. So we want to be careful in sticking in this kind of frictions and all sorts of restrictions on a permanent basis because we risk hampering and slowing financial development, which eventually is what contributes to allowing the interest rate to work better and the economy to function more smoothly. So at least from this modeling environment, which are much simpler, thinking about capital controls, it comes clear that the desirable optimal policy has to be state contingent with all the implications that these entail, including Carlos mentioned discretion versus commitment. There are time consistency issues that are very, very important. So to summarize, I think it's a great report. Reserve requirement is a tested old tool which has found a very useful new use. And is a very fertile ground for further understanding more generally the use of similar kind of tool. And there is a lot of work to be done, both on the empirical and the theoretical side, but I think this report is really an outstanding springbox to engage in that adventure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Alessandro. Now I'm in a sort of a dilemma, in the sense. These were great comments, and I think we can foster a debate that will last for the remaining of the session. And I would have some questions of by myself, or we can open it to the floor, take a few questions for the floor, and continue the debate. I will go for the second one, Guillermo and host. So let's then take some questions for the floor. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Arturo Porsekansky with American University. So I have not read the report, but from the way you presented it, it sounds to me more like a descriptive analysis of monetary policy rather than of macroprudential issues and policies. And as such, I think you need to find a way to bring in more explicitly the exchange rate regime, or at least some measure like exchange market pressure, which combines movements in the exchange rate and in international reserves, so that you can talk about what's happening on that front. Because I think any discussion of monetary policy that does not more explicitly discuss what's happening with the exchange rate regime, as you in your description, you have to add it exogenously, and it's really endogenous. Now, when I first heard the title Reserve Requirements Macroprudential, I thought you were going to talk about things like, for instance, the use of differential reserve requirements to minimize currency mismatches in the banking system, for instance, in which Latin America has very rich experience to share. I think if you think of going into a more macroprudential angle, that would be really interesting. What are the lessons from the use of differential reserve requirements? I think that some papers have already been published on this, but it's never too late to do it better. And speaking of macroprudential, I think some of the burning issues in developing countries today are not these, but other ones. For instance, credit allocation and especially by state-run banks. In other words, I think some of the macroprudential issues nowadays are really the quality of the balance sheet of the central banks, the quality of the balance sheet of the state-owned banks. If I was looking at Brazil, you know, I would look into macroprudential issues at Caixa Econômica Federal and BNDES. If I was looking at macroprudential issues in Argentina, I would look at what's in the central bank. Nothing good. So those are my comments.
Yes. Any other questions?
Gregorio Impavido, IMF. This substitutability between reserve requirements and monetary interest rate policy, is it a result because of a partial equilibrium view of the report? I mean, if you have a negative output shock, you can deal with it with fiscal policy too. Would that substitutability be reinforced by the use of a countercyclical fiscal policy? Because you don't see a lot of movement in the interest rate when monetary policy and fiscal policy coordinate. Should you consider, since you're talking about macro stabilization a lot, should you consider also fiscal policy first? And would this substitutability be reinforced if you consider fiscal policy?
Let's take another question.
Nicolas Magut, IMF. I have two more than questions, is suggestions or questions I have in mind, and I don't have the answer, so maybe you can think of a good answer. One is on the way you define the frequency, is one further way in which one can think of the implication of macroprudential is that it's not only the frequency, but there's some elasticity down there, right? So maybe you keep on increasing or decreasing because it's not working. I don't know how to solve that empirically, however. But I think it's a good thing to try to look at. And the second one is related to the analysis that you present on using safe reserve requirements to complement when you're doing an intervention, I mean, and defending the exchange rate. Now, in more, partly you're saying that, but I think there's more that you can take out of that, because more and more, once you have inflation targeting, and let's assume it's good enough, I agree with it, it's not perfect, but it's good enough. The thing is that then you that's probably why you need reserve requirements or other macroprudentials to be more a substitute over time, because then you have all this carry trade story that will stimulate domestic credit, domestic demand. So then even if you maybe raise interest rate, and that could be theoretically at least contractionary, expansionary if the domestic demand expands too fast owing to domestic credit. So those are things that I think it could be more analysis going forward.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Amadou C. from Brookings. Just a couple of questions. I mean, if you look at the use of reserve requirements, like in countries like India, where they're very high, or Pakistan, it's a very convenient tool for the government to fund itself because the eligibility of the assets are mostly treasury bills. So you're kind of forcing banks to buy your paper. So I don't know if fiscal dominance also could be an interesting issue, whether countries with more or less fiscal dominance are different in your sample. Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you for the panel. I'm Enes Sunal from Central Bank of Turkey, and I'm a previous student of Carlos. Great to see he's here with this brilliant report. So I just want to make a very small contribution here. I don't know how you studied the interaction between reserve requirement policies and the conventional monetary policy framework. But just from a personal observation, in the case of Central Bank of Turkey, we realized that the effectiveness of required reserves to slow down credit growth is enhanced when the inflation, conventional inflation targeting framework is foregoed. What I want to mean here is that it's got to be complemented with proactive liquidity policy. What I mean is if the overnight lending rate of central bank is close to the policy rate, which means that quantity of money is endogenous, when you increase required reserves, even if you increase required reserves a lot, banks might borrow it from the central bank in the overnight market easily, which still facilitates them to increase credit. So the so-called innovation of the Central Bank of Turkey was to push up the upper bound of the interest rate corridor and play with the liquidity in the overnight market in a day-to-day, on a daily basis, to make sure that reserve requirements are really effective in slowing down credit. Just a small contribution. Thank you.
Please.
I'm Priya Puran. I don't mean to be extremely pessimistic on the wonderful research, but I have one comment more than a question. Macroprudential policy is not new. If we're speaking about the advances in the last 5 years since the crisis, what's potentially original is macroprudential supervision. Now, there is some overlap, but they're not exactly the same things, and I feel that this general debate on the macroprudential world has sort of lost its objectives, some clarity in terms of its objectives, and it's become an extremely broad debate that's at this point probably at risk of losing definition. So the two concepts are not the same, and I think they're being confused, and macroprudential supervision is really aimed at mitigating crisis events and fostering financial stability, which is a little bit different. The second comment is that I really have to question the reliance on this group analysis, that groups of countries, let's say emerging markets or developing countries, may bear commonalities that would justify similar measures. I'm not sure that that exactly is the case. And I feel one has to be a bit cautious of relying on that sort of analysis.
Yes, let's take another one and then...
Oh, sorry, everybody. I speak on my own behalf. To Mr. Klassen's the first point, the question of political economy, you know, rises. It seems to me that, you know, it's somewhat, you know, not really taken into account, and especially in industrial economies or countries. For if you were to, for example, take the U.S., France, Spain, and I suppose it was slide 9, it is fair to say that it's going to be a bit of a challenge, you know, to undertake the policies which might be suitable to, let's say, Latin America and some other countries without a pushback. In fact, the pushback is going to be massive, making it a bit difficult to design an optimal framework. And insofar as the framework is concerned, and the question will be perhaps not to Mr. Klassen, not to the author of the report, how do we account for discrepancies within financial systems across the industrial world in addition to emerging markets? Thank you.
Okay, look, since we have so many questions, I think we have so little time. So my idea is just to give back to the panelists. I might have a few comments by myself. But I think the idea is try to, well, I don't think we can answer to all those questions, but I think some of the themes you might want to touch upon is the fact is whether this buzz about macroprudential policy is something new or just calling by macroprudential policy that have already been implemented in a while, especially in emerging markets. And the other thing is that whether there is a lot of, and this is very much linked to what Alessandro was saying on inflation targeting, is there anything really advanced economy can learn from emerging market use of macroprudential policies, especially in the way we have discussed it today, or what mainly of most of this lesson is just sort of paying a lip tribute to what is already gone when the economies are very different? So, and this could be some of the themes we can touch, but otherwise, please sort of feel free. Why don't we go in the same order? Let's start with Guillermo, Carlos, Guillermo, and Stein and Alessandro.
Okay, so yeah, I'd like to thank both Stein and Alessandro for great comments, and also for all of you for very good questions. And many of the questions don't have an easy answer, and we'll keep working on this topic. The more you begin to look into a topic, the more you realize that you don't know, in some sense, that to me is actually a good sign that you are trying to get somewhere. So let me just touch very briefly on two, three main issues that have come up. So the first is Stein's point of having an analytical model to make sense of all these stellar facts that we have been able to uncover, and that I cannot agree more. I think it made sense to do it in the order that we actually did, which was to first to establish a pretty firm, I think, a set of stellar facts, comparing what the developing countries do compared to what in other countries do, and really get a sense of what they do and what they don't do, and then to develop a set of stellar facts so that when you get down to write an analytical model, you have a firm understanding of what are the type of facts that you like your theory to explain. We are doing that in a different paper that unfortunately we haven't been able to make as much progress so far, but we have a paper with Guillermo Pulitin and Julien Bengi, in which we develop a model with asset market segmentation. Obviously, you know, I mean, Olivier's comment, Olivier Blanchard made the comment that if you think about a very pure system, you can think that it is actually not possible for interest rate and reserve requirement to act as independent instruments, and of course the U.S. Would be in such a case. So it could be that in other countries do not use the two instruments, perhaps because financial markets are not segmented and therefore they don't have a chance to use the two instruments in an independent fashion, whereas if you're thinking about emerging markets in which you have much more asset market segmentation, they'll be able to use interest policy and reserve requirement policy as independent instrument. So, that's a model that we are working on as we speak. Very briefly, the point raised by Alessandro on the role of inflation targeting, I think, is very important. We are planning to explore, which is a dimension that we haven't explored. What is the relationship between IT and the substitutability of complementarity of requirement policy interest rate policy. We have very little time. I think the point of the fiscal policy, how fiscal policy would come into this package, we have looked a lot at fiscal policy, but sort of as an independent instrument, whether it is pro-cyclical or counter-cyclical, I think it is an excellent idea to put in the agenda to bring, to also bring fiscal policy in this four policy menu. I think that on Turkey, and I certainly would like to discuss that further because I think it is a nice way of trying in a framework in which there is not too much independence between reserve requirement policy and interest rate policy to try to introduce some imperfect substitution between the two. So I think I'm going to stop here, Tito, because...
Again.
Yeah, Carlos already touched upon many of the issues. Thank you very much for all the comments. On the empirical side, let me touch upon some of the things that could give us some hint in terms of the theory. One of the things we did in the paper was to understand the relationship between reserve requirements and interest rate policy in terms of interest rate spreads. One of the things, if we truly want to calibrate some sort of model, and in particular if we think about asset market segmentation, is trying to distinguish how it affects active and deposit rates, the lending and deposit rates in that sense. So we have this thing is just a matter of putting our hands. I think it's something we got a bunch of ideas to keep working on in those. In terms of the state contingent, we need to talk, and we are going to talk, I think, somewhere in lunch about all this stuff. Arturo pointed to a super good issue in terms of the difference in reserve requirements what happened was basically, at least one of the perceptions I have with this great data set that we put together is that we got this data set and we could go in so many dimensions. We tried to go in terms of getting some basic stylized facts that help us understand what is going on, but we truly have the detailed data in all these maturity and across currency reserve requirements, so we could have a lot of fun with that. And in terms of Nicolas' point about the effectiveness through the eyes of elasticities, we get somehow all the results based on legal reserve requirements because we're convinced that this is a policy tool and we should take a look at that, and we take a look at some outcome variables such as interest rate spreads, credit, capital flows, and so on and so forth. We don't have the data, but I guess it might not be that much hard to collect data set on effective or actual reserves at banks, because if one thinks that their reserves are not binding, then why should change it in that? One would hope that it is binding somehow because you see the response of the outcome variables, but it's something that we should definitely take a careful look to get the whole picture of a transmission mechanism. Thank you very much.
Stay.
What about this question on whether macroprudential is new or old? I mean, I think many of the tools we have used before, but I think the interpretation, whether it's on the macro or the micro side, the interpretation is different these days because I think we have a better understanding of the financial frictions that may motivate macroprudential, in my terminology, for financial stability purposes, maybe not as much in your terminology. But I think, nevertheless, identifying what these frictions are is very important because they will vary across countries. So Ireland and Spain you may have thought of as advanced countries, and maybe they were in the Nirvana at some point. Ireland as part of the Euro and Spain as well. But nevertheless, they would have benefited a lot of these other macroprudential tools because they're different financial frictions than a set of countries you're talking about in terms of Latin America. So understanding it better partly addresses a little bit of the political economy issue. Once we know better what the reasons is for using these tools, we can presumably deal better with political economy pushback because we can explain more, just like we've done with IT, inflation targeting, what the objective is in the first place.
I'd like to stress one lesson that I learned from the global crisis, which is pertinent here, is the fact that advanced economies, as emerging market for many years before, experienced both regular business cycles and events which are of a different nature, which are the financial crisis. And these are nested in the cycle. So what we need to do is to think in terms of these set of events, which have distinct dynamics when they occur, but they are within the same framework. So for this reason, macroeconomic policy has to take financial stability into consideration, and policies, macroeconomic policies, which are prudential in nature, which are preventive policy before the large shock, the financial crisis happens, takes place. So in this sense, I think I'm very much open, and I agree with Stein there is confusion, but we can use terminology to clarify all this. But the lesson learned is that not only emerging market, but also advanced economies experience both cycles and crises, and the policies for crisis have a different nature, and prudential policies are those policies that try to prevent crises. And this, to me, reveals why inflation targeting, which in the textbook is thought for regular business cycle, not always works. When we are in the midst of the crisis, be that the United States or any emerging market, arbitrage fails. Arbitrage doesn't work. That's why we have segmentation. That's why other instruments like reserve requirement can be used without conflicting with interest rate. And we, on the upside of the cycle, think about Dutch disease. I mean, regular exchange rate fluctuation, the exchange rate is there to move and to be a shock absorber. But when massive resources are shifted from one sector to another, different kind of consideration come into play and different type of tools are needed in addition to the standard business cycle stabilization tools.
Okay, just maybe we have very small comments in the margin of this. I think the real point is whether we should look at emerging market versus an advanced economy is a fair question. And honestly, what I think is rather than looking real developed versus developing, we should look a little bit of how some currency and country behaves over the business cycle. Some ongoing research is, for instance, in looking at countries that have pro-cyclical currencies, currencies that appreciate in good times and depreciate in bad times, versus countries that have anti-cyclical currencies, these currencies that
appreciating bad times and depreciating good ones, like the sort of reserve currencies. And if you take this classification, then you will have advanced economies that behave more like the emerging market, are the Australia, the New Zealand, and we have a bunch of maybe emerging markets will behave as advanced economies. So I think one of the things that this analysis taught us is that maybe one is level of development and the level of completeness of financial market, and another important thing that we should look at is how these economies are exposed to shock and are exposed to the global business cycle. Well, on this, since we already passed sort of noon, I would really like to thank Brookings for organizing the event. I want to organize Stein and Alessandro for coming and provide this very thoughtful very thoughtful discussion, and of course, my good co-author Guillermo and Carlos for their excellent presentation. Thank you so much, everybody.